Okay, the first case for argument this morning is number 043308, Benjamin Brooks versus the University of Wisconsin Board of Regents. Mr. Arnault.
Good morning, Your Honors. Good morning, Council members. I am Attorney Victor M. Mariano from Madison, Wisconsin, from the law firm of Lawton & Cates, and I represent the plaintiff's appellants, Dr. Benjamin Brooks, Dr. Muhammad Sanjak, and Ms. Jennifer Parnell. This is an appeal from the Western District of Wisconsin, the Honorable Shabazz, John Shabazz. We have submitted briefs, and I believe that Your Honors have those briefs. We incorporate those briefs to my oral argument. I was here in 1988, and I was nervous then. Several years later, I'm even more nervous. So,
well, don't be nervous. we're all from Wisconsin.
Me too. I will highlight some very brief facts in order to put this case in proper perspective. I will take 10 minutes, and we'll reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Dr. Brooks has been, for almost 22 years, a tenured member, professor of neurology and medical director of the LS and MS program within the University of Wisconsin Medical School. Dr. Brooks' programs were primarily financed by clinical research grants, and for many years, he has been very successful in generating thousands of dollars through his clinical research. Dr. Brooks was also the director of the Motor Performance Lab, otherwise known as the MPL, within the Department of Neurology. The Motor Performance Lab was created by Dr. Brooks specifically to test muscle techniques on patients with this terrible disease.
You know, it seems to me that the biggest problem you've got with this case is to show that is causation. Whether or not this exercise of speech by the Dr. Brooks and others was a motivating factor in the whatever happened thereafter, because is this just a policy dispute within the medical school as to the merits of Dr. Brooks' program, or is it, as you claim, a retaliation situation for the exercise free speech? And the problem with, if you can bring a lawsuit on this basis anytime there's a big policy difference in a department of the university and claim it's a suppression of free speech, where are we going with that program? I mean, that's my main problem with it.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. And I think that's a good question, and I will move into that direction right away. I believe that there are some highly disputed facts with respect to that particular issue. For example, the record reflects that from 1995 through the year 2000, this particular department was working free of any problems. The timing, although it's not decisive, is extremely important, because it was around the year 2000 when Dr. Brooks refused to sign a letter of support on behalf of the neurology chairman, Dr. Satula. If you look at the timing, Your Honor, from 1996 through the year 2000, this was a perfect functioning department. Immediately after that,
I assume, though, that before, 1996, that the head of the department, what's his name, Satula, didn't think very well of this program because they had this review committee, and I assume there wouldn't have been a review committee unless there was some opposition to the program. Isn't that right?
And I am glad that you raised that issue, because there was an investigation as a result of the concerns raised by Dr. Satula, and the Eichmann Committee was created. The Eichmann Committee investigated the concerns of Dr. Satula and concluded that the work that Dr. Brooks was conducting with his staff, with Dr. Sanjak and Ms. Parnell, was appropriate and was of very important nature. And that is so significant because it was the Eichmann Committee who specifically clarified the problems with Dr. Satula. I suspect that Dr. Satula probably wasn't too happy, but the fact of the matter...
Yeah, I don't know that Dr. Satula agreed with the committee.
That is true. However, as the record indicates, nothing was done from 1996 until the year 2000, and something happened. Three incidents of major significance happened. The first one is when Dr. Satula was sued in Wisconsin, and his staff, specifically one of his appointees, Dr. Fleming, circulates a letter of support to be sent to the dean of the school on behalf of Satula. Dr. Brooks had real concerns about the way Dr. Satula had handled that matter. Dr. Satula refused to sign the letter. Dr. Brooks talked to Dr. Satula and told him, "I didn't sign the letter. I'm sorry, I don't agree with it." He told Dr. Fleming. The very next issue that happened is when Dr. Brooks becomes very critical of the mishandling, as he perceived it, of the MDA program. The MDA program assisted people with this terrible disease, particularly people that were poor, that could not afford medical services. Dr. Satula was not too happy about that, because shortly thereafter, Dr. Satula suspended the clinical research privileges of Dr. Brooks. These two incidents created an adverse reaction, because the clinical privileges of Dr. Brooks are his livelihood. These are issues that are significant to him in order to operate. This was done without any procedural safeguards. The third item that occurred was that while his clinical research was being suspended, he went to Dr. DeLuca and complained about harassment and retaliation, but he also raised concerns about Dr. Satula's private investment in working with his business while working for the University of Wisconsin. What happened right there after that?
Fairly common, I would think, in a medical school, isn't it?
It may be, but I believe that it's speech that is protected. It's protected because it's a concern about the administration of government. It's protected because is a concern that he made as a private citizen. What happened after that, then Satula...
No, I mean, these private arrangements with drug companies, I assume, is not unusual in medical...
I think that there is a question as to whether or not the university can use staff or can use time that is allocated for university business while you have a private company. And that was one of the concerns that Dr. Brooks raised with Dr. DeLuca. What happened after that, Dr. Satula then announced the closing of the MPL without any reason whatsoever. When Dr. Muhammad Sanjak challenged the closing of the MPL, they then move into another very disputed issue. And the other disputed issue is that they created a scenario where a former student who had been terminated by Dr. Sanjak, they contacted this student to elicit negative information about the MPL, and they also found a student that was to be hired by Mr. Salazar, one of the defendants in this case, and they created this scenario that there was a safety violation. All these are highly disputed issues. One of the reasons why we believe these are pretext is because DeLuca, in his email, acknowledges that the university cannot suspend Dr. Brooks' clinical research. Secondly, Dr. Brooks' alleged dilatory dictation problems were no worse and no better than other doctors. The reason why this was a pretext is because the time when the so-called dictation problems existed, actually, Dr. Brooks was improving in his dictation problems after he made certain statements that we believe are protected. And the most significant thing is that there is no correlation between his lateness in his dictation and the suspension of his clinical research privileges. We believe, and it's a disputed fact, that Dr. Satula knew that by suspending his clinical privileges would cause the closing of the MPL. All of this is an adverse decision that was suffered by Dr. Brooks immediately after he became critical of these very important public issues that I have mentioned. For example, in the year 2000, the MPL was solvent financially. And when they realized that Dr. Muhammad was challenging their claim that the MPL was in financial trouble, that's when they created the second scenario, the so-called safety problem. We believe, number one, that the Honorable Shabazz failed to even address whether or not this constitutes public public matter. We believe also that if, in fact, the university was seriously concerned about safety, they could have gone to Dr. Brooks directly after they discovered the problem. But instead, they avoided Dr. Brooks, and for many weeks, Dr. Brooks had no clue as to why these folks were closing the lab. They didn't follow any procedures. They created the Hersey Committee to investigate the so-called safety problems. He appointed Dr. Fleming. I will reserve my 5 minutes for later. Thank you.
Mr. Sweeney.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is John Sweeney. I'm an Assistant Attorney General. I'm also proud to be from Wisconsin. And I'm happy to be here today representing the defendants, as I did in the district court. I also represented the defendants, as some of you may know, in the case Bicknies, which went to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. I'd like to address some of the remarks that Mr. Arellano made. And initially, I want to say to the court that one of the main problems with the plaintiff's case is the record. If you look at the defendant's proposed findings of fact and the plaintiff's responses thereto, the plaintiff's supplemental proposed findings of fact, we have objected repeatedly because the plaintiff's theories from First Amendment to Title VII, frankly, are not based on competent, inadmissible evidence. As you know, in the district court, we filed a motion to strike, and Judge Shabazz granted a part of that motion, and it's very clear from his opinion that he simply disregarded many of those proposed findings from the plaintiff and also the responses to the defendant's proposed findings of fact. One point I'd like to make clear. The Motor Performance Laboratory was closed at the end of 2003, not because of a difference of opinion as to whether it was valid, whether it was the best way to go about it, but the Compensation Committee, made up of a number of doctors from the Department of Neurology, determined in May of 2003 that it looked like the Motor Performance Lab would run out of money by the end of 2003, which was, in fact, the case. Secondly, as you recall, the Motor Performance Lab was suddenly closed down in August of 2003 when the head of the University of Wisconsin Hospital, his name was Dr. Ghetto. He wasn't a member of the medical school. And one of the assistant deans in the medical school became concerned about the operations, what was going on. There were apparently unauthorized people in the lab. And to say that this is orchestrated or concocted by the defendants, much less anybody at the university, is simply not addressed nor supported anywhere in the record.
I don't have the impression, though, that Dr. Satula was thought very highly of Dr. Brooks's research before all these events. I don't know what the record shows.
Well, to Dr. Brooks's credit, you know, doctors are very specialized. Dr. Satula was not involved in the area that Dr. Brooks was involved in. Dr. Brooks, and it's clear, is a world and a nationally renowned research person in ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, and that's not disputed at all. However, when we have a member of the faculty who neglects to dictate charts, sometimes for up to as long as 6 months, he's sometimes 400 to 600 charts behind. All the other doctors at the university are dictating charts promptly. And I do take issue that Dr. Satula knew that other doctors had similar problems. The evidence, the defendant's proposed findings are clear. There was no other doctor in the history of the University of Wisconsin that had such a hellish dictation practices. In the district court, Dr. Brooks submitted an affidavit saying that he had done a study of other doctors, and that was part of our motion to strike because none of the doctors that he supposedly did a study on and their dictation practices were involved in the neurology department.
What's your take on how big a deal it was that Brooks wouldn't sign that letter of support for?
It was something passed around at a staff meeting. And people apparently were free to sign or not to sign. And he does say that he told Dr. Satula that he refused to sign it. But if you look at his affidavit, when he says that, he says, after the meeting, subsequently after the meeting, I told him. We moved to strike that because, as Judge Shabazz found in many instances, there's no foundation. So there's no evidence in the record that Dr. Satula ever knew that Dr. Brooks refused to sign it. And my take on it is it happened in the year 2000, sometime in the year 2000. We don't know, based on this record, when that allegation was made. But frankly, it made no difference to Dr. Satula. He said he did look at the petition, and he simply has no recollection whether Dr. Brooks did or didn't sign. Well, Dr. Sanjak did sign.
So your take is that it wasn't a big deal.
The university is sued literally hundreds of times each year. It's good for business in my office. It's a matter of course as to what happens at the university.
How is it that a refusal to sign such a letter of support would constitute a speech that relates to a matter of public concern in the first instance?
Well,
we get to motivations and so forth.
It's the plaintiff's contention that whether you speak out or refuse to speak out is an expression of First Amendment. And frankly, I don't disagree with that. If he chose not to sign, under some circumstances, it might be an expression of public concern. But as we have said, this was a matter entirely within the medical school, within the Department of Neurology.
I have a little problem on this public concern. I don't know specifically with regard to signing the document, but closing up medical offerings in a public hospital of this sort certainly has a public impact. It obviously also has a private impact on Dr. Brooks, but just because it has a private impact doesn't mean it doesn't also have a matter of public concern, I believe. And if it didn't have a private impact, we wouldn't have any lawsuits, of course.
Correct.
But that's frequently the case.
The MPL, as we have referred to it, is a testing area. It has nothing to do with the treatment or care of any of the patients at the University of Wisconsin Hospital, which you should note is a separate entity from the University of Wisconsin. What goes on at the hospital is different from what goes on at the medical school. And it's undisputed in the record that the treatment and care of patients were not affected in any way. Judge Cudahy, I'd like to give you an example of which I hope would explain from our perspective what is private, what is public. My associates and I work in the Department of Justice, and we believe that what we do affects the public. And frankly, we think it does. However, that does not translate into if I complain to my supervisor about what I am told to do and how I am told to do it, that then becomes a matter of public concern. Obviously, government offices are run with a great deal of discretion on the part of supervisors, and because I have a complaint and because I believe that my work has an effect on the general public, that does not translate, I believe, into something that's protected by the First Amendment.
No, but isn't it a First Amendment or a matter of public concern whether this hospital conducts this kind of research or not? It seems to me that has some impact on the public.
There is, and it's not a part of this record, but there is other ALS and related research going on at the University of Wisconsin and at the University of Wisconsin Hospital. That's been going on forever. And because one doctor loses one particular clinic does not mean that all studies
I mean,
related
the
to...
In the case, the issue was how do you run this office, as I recall. That didn't have much impact outside of the office, but here we're dealing with a lot bigger institution.
That's correct. And that testing lab, like all other testing labs at the university hospital, must be run with training, with having only authorized people having access to medical records, and it must be financially stable. And it's clear, undisputed by the plaintiffs even, that in May of 2003, the Compensation Committee, made up of members of the neurology department, forecasted that at the end of 2003 there's not enough money there to continue this. And there is the option at the university, if all of the operational problems are taken care of, and assured to the hospital and to the med school that that clinic can open again. And I suggest to you, Your Honors, as we've said in our brief, that Dr. Brooks and his associates' argument that there was an evil group of people at the medical school and at the hospital, that literally hundreds of doctors and additional hundreds of medical personnel had some type of evil conspiracy against Dr. Brooks, just as preposterous, and it's not supported by the record. A doctor who is world-renowned, nationally renowned, is an asset to any university, but that does not mean that he or she does not follow the rules of professionalism, which in this case means you must do your dictations and you must show up and not leave patients waiting for hours in the clinic. A period of time, Dr. Brooks's dictations improved slightly. He was given the opportunity to apply for one additional grant to conduct additional research. This record closed in December 2003, and from April of that year until the end of that year, there's no application for an additional grant by Dr. Brooks.
Was it his dictation or his charting that was?
Well, it's dictation. You get it to a point where it's on a chart.
Doctors dictate first and then they chart later. But
that's correct. And the Dr. Brooks made an argument, well, I had dictated, I just had not charted. Dr. Satula and Dr. Fleming said, we're sorry, and there are a variety of reasons. Medical malpractice, if you're a patient and your chart is 6 months behind and you're prescribed additional medication, that could be a problem. And there is no other doctor in the history of the University of Wisconsin that had a record similar to Dr. Brooks, and that's undisputed in the record. If you have no further questions, thank you very much.
Your Honor, in response to your concern, case of Wood versus Georgia, 370 U.S. 375, 82 Supreme Court 1364, the Supreme Court ruled that the right to remain silent is protected.
I don't question that. What I question is whether a refusal to sign a petition of support for the head of the department in connection with an employment dispute, a routine kind of garden variety employment dispute, constitutes speech on a matter of public concern.
If in fact, and this is one of the disputed issues, if in fact an adverse action resulted from such omission or refusal to sign the letter, we contend.
You've got to establish as a threshold matter that constituted speech on a matter of public concern.
The
Bickney's case was just an employment dispute internal to the university, and merely because it resulted in litigation that went to the Wisconsin Supreme Court doesn't necessarily make it
true
a matter of public concern for purposes
However,
of the First Amendment.
If Dr. Brooks was concerned with respect to how Dr. Satula was running the department, And we can see this in the Winescott versus Henry 315 Federal 3rd 844 7th Circuit 2003 decision, where Mr. Winescott was somewhat critical about how the city was running its business. Dr. Brooks was very concerned about the way the university was running, at least the Department of Neurology, and why the university was going to be paying $375,000. This particular court has ruled that anyone that complains about mismanagement or has any concerns about the effective or efficient manner, it's clearly a matter of public concern. With respect to counsel's statement as to whether or not there's a bunch of evil people in this particular case, let me just remind you that Dr. DeLuca sends an email to Dr. Satula where he tells him in private, we have to get an expert. We can't continue to deny Dr. Brooks his clinical research privileges. All of these, the elimination of the MPL, which was a creation of Dr. Brooks, it was not a creation of the Department of of neurology of Dr. Satula. All of this occurred immediately after Dr. Brooks was critical of Dr. Satula with respect to the MDA. The MDA deals with serving the public, as Your Honor identified. These are matters of public concern. This is a program that would allow people with this disease, wheelchairs, medical treatment. Dr. Satula was very concerned about the handling of this particular program. The same thing happened in the Conner versus Reinhardt case, 847 Federal 2nd 384, which I argue here before this circuit in 1988, where an employee's ability to highlight misuse of public funds or breaches of public trust is a critical weapon in the fight against government corruption and or inefficiency. Now, we're not claiming corruption, but we're claiming that Dr. Brooks had a concern as to whether or not Dr. Satula's personal business mingled with the university business created a conflict of interest. And I believe that that also is a protected issue. As far as Dr. Brooks' dictation, one thing that counsel did not address is the fact that his lateness in dictation had nothing to do with his clinical research. We're talking about two totally different matters. And the fact of the matter that they would not allow Dr. Brooks to know, they would not allow to give him an opportunity to understand why they were closing the MPL. All of these issues, in my view, raise a disputed issue. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.